The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I am Sheldon Bonovitz, a member of the Free Library Foundation Board of Directors and a supporter of the Free Library, including tonight's Jill and Sheldon Bonovitz Endowed Lecture. It's my great pleasure to introduce David Brooks to you. As described by the Wall Street Journal, David Brooks is a clever and insightful inspector of the American scene. David feels that the happiness which comes from material accumulation is fleeting. There is another kind of happiness that comes from helping others, which David calls joy. David dubs this happiness the second mountain, the title of his book. The first mountain's primary goal is self-satisfaction. The second mountain is a life devoted to service which brings gratification, delight, and satisfaction. The book's second mountain is the story of David's climb toward faith. David has written an op-ed column for the New York Times since 2003, and he frequently appears on PBS's NewsHour, Meet the Press, and NPR's All Things Considered. David's books include the best-selling Bobo in Paradise, The Social Animal, and The Road to Character, a look at the melange of traits that can lead to the path of substantive living. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming David Brooks to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thank you. It's good to be back home. Some of you may know I went to Radnor High School. Okay. The four employed graduates of Radnor High School are back there. You should know my debate partner was a guy named Tom Wilson who went off to play Biff in the Back to the Future movies. He was so very, very distinguished class. Because I'm here, I get to be with my father who's here in the audience. And a dear friend from college, Stacy Dutton, who I'm going to pick on in a few minutes. So I'm going to tell two stories here tonight, and because this is an age of narcissism, they're both about myself. But I hope they're not solely about me and also about other people. And the first story is the external story, the way life appears from the outside, and then the second story is the internal story, which is a lot more complicated. And so the external story started when my family and I were living in New York City, and I was seven, and I read a book called Paddington the Bear. And my father's actually here to fact-check this. I hope it's true. My memory is I read that book, and I decided at age seven I wanted to become a writer, and have been writing almost ever since. When I went to Radnor, there was a young woman there named Bernice who I wanted to date, and she didn't want to date me. She wanted to date some other guy. And I remember thinking, what is she thinking? I write way better than that guy. And so we had different values. And then when I was 18, the admissions officers at Columbia, Wesleyan, and Brown decided I should go to the University of Chicago. And when Stacy and I were there, it really was where fun goes to die. Now that's not true anymore. Now my favorite saying about Chicago is, it's a Baptist school where atheist professors teach Jewish students St. Thomas Aquinas. And so, so I was a double major at Chicago. I majored in history and celibacy while I was there. And I'm going to resist the joke about Stacy of those days. But I had the big break of my life when I was there, which was when I was a senior, William F. Buckley came to campus, and I wrote a parody of him for being a name-dropping blowhard. And there were jokes in there like, at Yale, Buckley formed two magazines, one called the National Buckley, one called the Buckley Review, which he merged to form the Buckley. And he gave a speech to the student body. At the end of the speech, he said, David Brooks, if you're in the audience, I want to give you a job. And that really happened. That was sort of the big break of my life. Now, sadly, I was not in the audience. And what had actually happened was that I had been hired by Milton Friedman to go to Stanford and debate him on national TV. He had a show where he debates college students. And I was then a young socialist, and you can go on YouTube, and if you Google or YouTube David Brooks Milton Friedman, you'll see a picture of a 21-year-old me with a big head of hair and these 1980 gigantic glasses that were apparently on loan from the Mount Palomar Lunar Observatory there. And the show is basically me making some argument I'd read in some textbook, him destroying it in about six words, and then me sitting there for 19 seconds with my mouth open trying to think of something to say. And so then, but then I finally called up Buckley 3 years later or so, and he gave me a job. And that was my big break, and I then went on to become, I was hired to replace William Safire as the conservative columnist of the New York Times, a job I often likened to being the chief rabbi at Mecca. And then I got this job at the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer with Mark Shields. And we have a segment called Shields and Brooks. We should have called it Brooks Shields. That would have been better, but they didn't go for that. And if you, it's now Shields and Brooks. Before that, it was Shields and Gigot, if anybody, longtime viewers. Before that, it was Shields and Gergen. Then it was Shields and Coolidge, I think, going back in time. And so we cater to a certain audience, a demographic we call seasoned youth. And so if a 93-year-old lady comes up to me in the airport, I know what she's going to say. I don't watch your show, but my mother loves it. And so very big in the hospice community. And so I did that, and then I had the book side of my life, which is I write these books, and I read a lot of Brooks, and as I get older, my tastes get a little more feminine. I think we get softer as we get older. I'm the only American man to finish that book, Eat, Pray, Love, if you remember that book. By page 123, I was actually lactating, which was surprising. And then I wrote this book 4 years ago called The Road to Character, and I learned writing that book that writing a book on character doesn't give you good character. And reading a book on character doesn't give you good character, but buying a book on character does give you good character. So I recommend that. And so, so that's the external story of my life, and it's pretty straightforward. The internal story is more complicated. I went back and read Paddington the Bear, and it's a very complicated emotional story. It's about a bear who comes from Peru, gets lost in a train station in England, and a family takes him in. And as I was reading it, I remembered the intensity I felt when I first read it. And there's this thing I call in the book an annunciation moment. There's moments, sometimes early in life, sometimes late, which prefigure a lot of what's going to happen later. The moment we find out why we were put on this earth. And one of the people I really admire is a scientist named E.O. Wilson. And when Wilson was seven, he was growing up in Alabama, and his parents were getting divorced, and they shipped him away to a family that he didn't know in a place called Paradise Beach in northern Florida. And he didn't like the family, so he just spent the summer wandering the beach. He'd never seen the ocean before, or the bay, or the Gulf. And he saw animals that were outside his previous imagination. He saw a jellyfish. Imagine seeing a jellyfish. You never could imagine that animal. One day he was sitting on the dock, and a stingray floated underneath his feet. And he calculated that children see animals as twice the size as adults. And he said at that moment a naturalist was born. He was losing a family back in Alabama, but he discovered something that called to him, which was nature. And he became a naturalist from starting at age seven. And what's interesting about that moment, how he found his calling, really was how aesthetic it is. The Greek word for beauty is to call, and he was just sort of called to beauty. And when you follow what seems beautiful, Nietzsche says, if you want to find out what the law of your very self is, take the four most beautiful moments of your life and see if you can draw a thematic line through them. And so a beautiful thing just calls us. My daughter, at age five, went into a hockey rink and felt immediately at home. It's now 20 years later, but she teaches hockey out in Anaheim with the Anaheim Ducks. Einstein, when he was four, he was given a compass, and he noticed how the invisible forces were moving the needle of the compass, and he spent the rest of his life studying the invisible physical forces of the universe. Annie Dillard asked a painter, why did you become a painter? And the painter just said, I love the smell of paint. And there's an intensity of childhood appreciation of beauty, which is very powerful. And I remember when I read that book, how intensely children can feel that sense of active engagement and lose themselves in something. Now, Wilson's Annunciation moment had one final thing, which was he was out fishing at the end of the summer. He caught a fish. As he was taking it off the hook, it slipped out of his hand, flapped into his face, and the tail fin poked his retina. He stayed out in the ocean because he didn't want to go in because he loved the ocean, even though he's in excruciating pain, and lost vision in that eye. And so he couldn't study birds, which require stereoscopy or whatever it's called. He couldn't study fish, but he could hold up ants to his good eye, and he studied ants. And sometimes it's a blessing to have some options closed off. The second thing we have in children is the capacity to admire. We sort of lose it as adults because we get to know people better or something. But I remember when I was a kid looking at teenagers and thinking they were like godlike. They seemed to have it all together. They could do things I couldn't do. And so we also have mentors, and I had Buckley, who I had lavishly admired. For E.O. Wilson, it was this guy named Philip Darlington, who was a professor at Harvard, another naturalist, who taught him how to do his craft well. Darlington said, when you collect your samples, don't go on the trails, cut through the jungle. And one day Darlington was out collecting samples in the Amazon. He floated out on a log and was collecting on a lake or a pond, and a crocodile came up and grabbed him and dragged him down under the water. Darlington escaped, the crocodile grabbed him again, dragged him under the water, finally escaped again, the right side of his body completely shredded, and dragged himself back to camp and eventually safety. And Wilson said, that's not really what I admired. Anybody can get away from a crocodile. What he really admired is that in a full body cast for the next several months with his right arm immobilized, Darlington went out and taught himself how to collect his samples left-handed. And so I think that's something we want, especially as young people. We don't want happiness, we want intensity. We want to be taught that something is hard and that it's worthy of the hardness. And so these are the intensities of youth. And when Stacy and I are in Chicago, we had professors who had the intensity around the great books. And there's a saying, if you catch fire with enthusiasm, people will come for miles to watch you burn. And I would say our professors thought the great books had the keys to the kingdom of life. And forever after, they made it harder to be shallow because you had tasted the wine. And that intensity was, I think, part of our youth. Now, we do a good job of quelling that intensity. We take our most promising 15 and 16-year-olds and put them through the college admissions process, which teaches them that status and accomplishment are at the center of life. And then we put them through the lies of our culture. We live in a very individualistic culture, a very meritocratic culture, and it's got a lot of good features. It creates a lot of great achievement. It also has some lies embedded in it. And one of them is career success can make you feel fulfilled. And if there's a lot of evidence that's not true, you can ask Kate Spade. It's not true. The second lie is I can make myself happy. This is the lie of self-sufficiency. If I could just lose 15 more pounds, become really good at yoga or have some more victory, then I would be happy. But if you talk to people on their deathbeds and ask them what really made them happy, it's never self-sufficiency, it's the opposite of self-sufficiency. It's deep relationship when they were utterly dependent on somebody else and somebody else was utterly dependent on them. Then there's the lie that life is an individual journey. These days at commencements, we give the kids this book, Oh, the Places You'll Go by Dr. Seuss. And if you look at that, it's about an individual boy going through a series of experiences on his way to success. He has no friends, he has no family, he has no attachments. And somehow we've got that embedded in our lives, that's what life is. And I just ran into a Stanford sociologist who studies this book and the reaction to it, and immigrant kids hate this book because it doesn't reflect life as they know it. But we live in this individualistic culture. And then we have all the other lies of the meritocracy, that you are with what you accomplish, that you can achieve dignity by attaching yourself to prestigious brands, that society is divided into a series of inner rings with the more accomplished people at Davos and everybody else further out, that the anthropology of the meritocracy is that you're not a soul to be saved, you're a set of skills to be maximized, and the judgment is that people who are smarter and more accomplished are worth slightly more. And so what we do with this whole system is we turn off the moral switch. Israel, there was a daycare center there several years ago that had a problem that the parents were coming in late, and the teachers had to hang around until the kids were all gone. And so they decided to impose fines on parents who came in late. The number of parents who came in late tripled. Because what had been before been a moral responsibility to be there for the teachers suddenly turned into an economic transaction. And so the moral switch was turned on and the economic switch was turned off. And so we can do that, and we do that with our cultures. And what we do is we create a life that's unsustainable. So people climb the first mountain thinking they're going to have a good career, make an identity, and then usually something happens. Sometimes they achieve success and find it unfulfilling. They have to do something else. It wasn't what they thought it was. Or they get fired and they're failing. They're no longer climbing that mountain. Or something happens that wasn't part of the original plan. They have a cancer scare, they lose a child, and suddenly the desires of the ego don't seem that important. And suddenly they're down in the valley. And valleys happen to all of us at one point. And the certain sort of valley that's common now is a valley of disconnection. And so I would say that happened to me. I start out in a profession that requires, it encourages people to be a little detached anyway. I tell journalism students, if you're at a football game and everybody's doing you during the wave, and you sit there and you don't do the wave, you have the right kind of aloof personality type to be a journalist. Because we don't do stuff, we just watch other people do stuff. As Gary Shandling said, my friends tell me I have an intimacy problem, but they don't really know me. And then you go into a profession where you're going to spend a lot of time alone. John Cheever, I think he wrote in New York City, he got up in the morning, he put on a suit and tie, he rode the elevator down to his building, down to the basement of his building where he had an office, he took off the suit and tie, he rode in his underwears, and then he put at 12:30 he put back on the suit and tie, rode up to the apartment and made himself lunch. That's the solitary life of a writer. And then if you get successful, you get even more isolated, weirdly. My last book did well commercially. I was on a book tour for 99 days, and I counted 42 consecutive meals eaten alone, either at an airport, hotel, or airplane. And when you're that alone on the road that much, you lose all your bearings, and you're weirdly just off the rails. And around this time, I saw a picture of Britney Spears who'd kind of gone berserk and shaved off all her hair. And I was like, yeah, I could do that. I'm there. I could do that. And so you're weirdly disconnected. And your life begins to revolve around the disconnection. And so in 2013, my kids had left home or were leaving home. My marriage had ended. A lot of my social circles were in the conservative world, but conservatism was no longer my kind of conservatism, so all that drifted away too. And so I did what any normal person would do, is I tried to solve the problem by being a workaholic. And if you had gone to my apartment where I was living, and you opened the doors in the kitchen where there should have been stationery, or where there should have been silverware, there were post-it notes. And where there should have been plates, there were stationery and envelopes. So I was sort of just isolated, alone, listening to a lot of sad Irish songs from Sinead O'Connor. And so I was falling into a valley. And the weird thing is that as I was falling into a valley of disconnection, so was a lot of America. Over the last several years, we've seen this massive rise of solitude and disconnection. 35% of Americans over 45 are chronically lonely. 55% of Americans say no one knows them well. Only 8% of Americans report having important conversations with their neighbors. The suicide rate is up by 30%. The teenage suicide rate since 2011 is up by 70%. 72 Americans die from opiate addictions every year. If you ask people, do you trust your neighbors? A generation ago, 60% of Americans said, yeah, my neighbors are trustworthy. Now it's 32% and 18% of millennials. The younger down you go, the more distrust there is. And so you have this social isolation and anger and a breakup of the social fabric. And so the question is, how do you get out of a valley? Well, I am an expert in this question. I spent the last 6 years thinking about this. And so when I was in the valley, I had a few big realizations. One, freedom sucks. Political freedom is good, economic freedom is pretty good, social freedom is no good. all my married friends were projecting all their fantasies on me that I was going to be a swinging bachelor. But the uncommitted man is unremembered because he's really not attached to anything. And so I came to the conclusion quickly, freedom was no good. Second, you can be broken or you can be broken open. We all know people who've been broken by bad moments. They get afraid, they get resentful, they lash out. They usually cause anger to people around them. There's a great phrase, pain that is not transformed gets transmitted. And people who are broken and fearful turn tribal. Tribal seems like a way to get community, but it's really the reverse negative version of community. Community is based on mutual affection for a place or something. Tribalism is based on mutual hatred for some other. And tribalism is always a scarcity mindset. It's always zero sum. It's always us, them. Build walls, erect barriers. And we got a lot of tribalism as a result of our loneliness in this country. But other people get broken open. What happens is, as Paul Tillich said, suffering interrupts your daily life and reminds you you're not the person you thought you were. He says, what suffering does, it carves through what you thought was the floor of the basement of your soul, and it carves through that, revealing a cavity, and then it carves through the next floor and reveals a cavity below that you see deeper into yourself than you ever had. And what you see are layers of different sorts of desires. On the first mountain, we're doing a lot of reputation management, the desires of the ego, to people like me. But there are two other sources of desires. And the first is the desire of the heart, the desire for connection with one another. And I read about a guy recently who bought a house with bamboo next to the driveway, and he hated bamboo. So he chopped it down, took an axe to the root system, dug a 3-foot hole, poured plant poison in there, 3 feet of gravel, 6 inches of concrete. 2 years later, little shoot of bamboo coming up through the ground. And in my view, we all have that. When you go see kids at a school play in fourth grade, you see their desire to do well. We're driven by our desires. As a friend of mine, Jamie Smith says, we're existential sharks. We're always desiring something. We're always on the move. And what we desire most of all is a sense of connection, the kind of connection that Louis de Bernier described in his book, Captain Corelli's Mandolin. In that book, he's got an old guy talking to his daughter about his relationship with his late wife. And the guy says, love itself is what is left over when being in love is burned away. And this is both an art and a fortunate accident. Your mother and I had it. We had roots that grew towards each other underground. And when all the pretty blossoms had fallen from our branches, we found out that we were one tree and not two. And that's what the heart wants. The second source of desire, and a different set of desires, is the soul. Now, I don't ask you to believe in God or not believe in God. That's not my department. But I do ask you to believe you have a soul, that there's some piece of you that has no weight, size, color, or shape, but gives you infinite value and dignity. That slavery is wrong because it's an oppression of another person's soul. That rape isn't just an attack on a bunch of physical molecules. It's an insult to a soul. And what a soul does, first, is it gives us moral responsibility. A tiger's not morally responsible for what it does, but we are morally responsible for what we do. And the other thing it does is it gives us a yearning to be good. I've covered a lot of bad people in my career, people who've committed genocide, war crimes. I've never met anybody who didn't want to be good. Everybody has some explanation for why their life is really good. And I think we all have that desire. And when you get down in those lowest places, then you come to your third realization, which is that your problems are not going to be solved at the same level of consciousness at which you created them. And that's an Einstein observation. So you go down into yourself, and when you're down in yourself, you find what Annie Dillard calls your illimitable and complex ability to care for each other. I have a friend who, when her daughter was born, she said, I found I loved her more than evolution required. And I've always liked that, because there are some things we do for evolutionary reasons, but there are some things we do to pay the rent, but there's some excess in human that is not there in penguins. Penguins are very loyal to each other, but there's some excess. And that excess is our ability to care and to do good things for one another. And when you've gone down into that place, you're ready for a second and bigger life. Then the fourth realization I had is that you can't get yourself out of the valley on your own. Somebody has to reach down and pull you out. And I got a lucky break in 2013. I got invited over to a house of a couple named Kathy and David. And they had a kid in the DC public schools named Santi. And Santi had a friend named James whose mom had some health and other issues. And so James often didn't have any food and any place to live. So they said, James can live with us. And James had a friend, and that kid had a friend, and that kid had a friend. So the first time I went over to dinner, about 6 years ago, they had about 40 kids around the table and 15 sleeping around the house. And so I walk in there, and there's all these kids around. I reach out to shake one of the first kids' hands, and he goes like this. He says, we don't shake hands here. We just hug here. And I'm not the huggiest guy on the face of the earth, but they hug, so I hug back. And I've been doing that almost every Thursday since. And what they have is a technology for convening, which is the dinner table. We sit around the dinner, we have the same meal every Thursday night, chicken and black rice, and we share what we have. Sometimes it's good news, kid passes the GED, gets a job. Sometimes it's bad news, depression, teenage pregnancy. One of the young women in the community lost, her kidney failed, and David, the father figure, gave him one of his. And so it's just a warm, I took my daughter there once, and she walked out and said, that's the warmest place I've ever been in my life. I took a guy named Bill Milliken who started an organization called Communities in Schools, and he's about in his 70s, and he said, you know, I've been doing this for about 50 years. I've never seen a program turn around a life. What changes lives are relationships. And so that's what they build at this table, just thick relationships. And they do it for us, they do it for the kids. And so that really being part of that community taught me a better way to live and just a more emotional transparency. And the good news, and so they sort of reached out and held me out. The good news is that we have people like that all over the country. For the past years, as part of the Aspen Institute, I've been traveling around the country meeting community builders. We call them weavers. This is our little logo here. I was just with 250 of them today. And they're everywhere. People like that are everywhere. I was just today with a woman named Aisha Butler who lives in Chicago, lives in a dangerous neighborhood called Englewood in Chicago. And she was going to move out because a bullet went through her front window. It was dangerous. And the moving vans were there, she looks across the street. She's an empty lot. And there's a little girl in a pink dress playing with broken bottles. And she turns to her husband and says, we're not leaving. We're not going to be just another family who left that. So she Googles volunteer in Englewood, and she starts volunteering. And now she runs something called RAGE, which is the big community organization. And these people are literally everywhere. You probably know them. Some of them are probably you, these weavers. A friend of mine named Mac McCarter lives in Shreveport, Louisiana. There are about 300,000 people in Shreveport, 55,000 volunteer in his organization. And every block there's a host family and they have social life organized for that block. Some of the people who are weavers have had amazingly bad experiences. I was just with them today, so it's all very fresh for me. Darius Baxter, his dad, had an affair with a stripper when he was 9 and the stripper killed him. And Darius now runs a football camp for young African-American men so they can have father figures. Woman I was with today, Sarah Atkins, lives in Appalachian, Ohio. She came home one Sunday and found that her husband had killed her kids and himself. And she now runs a free pharmacy, has a foundation for moms who have suffered from violence, and teaches at Ohio University. And she told me when I first met her about a year ago, I grew from this experience because I was angry. I was going to fight back against what he tried to do to me by making a difference in the world. See, he didn't kill me. My response to him is, whatever you meant to do to me, fuck you, you're not gonna do it to me. And these people have a bright sadness. They've seen the worst, but they're still very bright individuals and very giving individuals. Their life is pure gift. And they have different traits that are almost the exact opposite of the traits of the individualistic meritocracy I described before. They have moral motivation. They're not interested in money. They're not interested in being famous. They just wanna be in right relationship with others and do something good for their town. They have vocational certitude. It's not like, oh, I'm going to do this for 5 years and then I'll quit. They say, I'm going to die doing this. This is why I was put on this earth. They're deeply rooted. They're not cosmopolitan, frankly. They just love their town and they're totally committed to the town. There's a woman I met from North Carolina, from Wilkesboro, named Elby. She's probably 25. She said, I belong to Wilkes. I just belong to this town. It owns me. They have radical hospitality. If somebody knocks on their door, they always open, and they always put relationship over their self. They're geniuses at relationship. if people got into Harvard for being good at relationship, they'd all be at Harvard. And what they do is they reach down and pull people out. One of my favorite organizations is in Canada. It's called Roots of Empathy, run by a woman named Mary Gordon. And what they do is they want to teach empathy, so they take moms and infants of about 12 to 14 months and put them in classrooms with eighth graders. And they sit on a green carpet, and the eighth graders surround them, and they have to guess what's in the infant's mind as it crawls around and reaches for things. It's a way to teach theory of mind, really. And there was one kid in a class named Darren who'd been through the foster care system and had been held back a bunch of years, so he was much bigger than everybody else, and he asked to hold the baby. And the mom was nervous because Darren was so big and scary. But she gave him the baby, and Darren was great with the baby, cuddled the baby, cradled it, and Darren gave it back. And then he started asking questions about parenting, and the last question was, if nobody has ever loved you, do you still think you can be a good father? And so what Mary Gordon is doing is she's reaching down to the Darrens of the world and lifting them out. And so we're now in a valley of tribalism and separation and disconnection. And I look at the Weavers as one of the ways to get out of it. We have a culture of hyper-individualism, and we have to move to some sort of culture that's much more connected. And Joseph Campbell said there are two kinds of heroes: the heroes of the deed, who does something to serve the community, but also spiritual heroes, who show us a new and better way to live. And one theory of how culture changes is that a small group of people find a better way to live and the rest of us follow them and copy them. And that sort of happened with the 60s. It sort of has happened through time, when people just find a better way to live. And our job at Weave is just to take the Weavers and illuminate them, so young people can see, oh, that's a better way to live. And when people have found that better way, they're on their second mountain. And some of the people radically change their lives at that moment. When they go on their second mountain, they're out of the valley, they've found a reason for live. The first mountain is about building up the ego and defining the self. The second mountain is about shedding the ego and losing the self. The first mountain is about acquisition. The second mountain is about contribution. The first mountain is elitist, you're climbing upward. The second mountain is egalitarian, you're reaching yourself downward. And some people, you know, they quit their jobs and they go off to Tibet. Some people radically change their lives. I was with a woman this morning, another Weaver, named Lisa Fitzpatrick, who's a healthcare executive. She was in the passenger seat of a car. She turns her head in New Orleans and sees a 10 and 11-year-old boy with something in their hands. They lift it, it's a gun. They shoot her in the face, and she recovers, and she remembers that I wasn't a victim here, I was just collateral damage, because the 10 and 11-year-old boys need to have some family, so they need to do a gang, so they needed to do the initiation ritual, which involves shooting a random person. And so she quit her job, and now she works with gang members. And so that's a radical change. Most people don't quit their jobs, they just stay in the same place. But they're relationships are different toward it. It's really about shining light on others. I work for a guy at the Aspen Institute who used to run Franklin and Marshall School, and he's just always a person for others. It's always, how can I help you? What can I do for you? I worked for a guy named Jim Lehrer, and Lehrer was about making you the star. And one of the things I did early in my career was I would speak on the air, and if I said something that Lehrer liked, his eyes would crinkle in pleasure. And if I'd said something he disliked, his mouth would turn down in displeasure. And so for 10 years, I just tried to get the eye crinkle and avoid the mouth downturn. And in that way, he taught me how to be a TV pundit. He had his own moral ecology around him that radiated out from him just by his reactions, his small reactions. And he's been retired for about 5 years, but that moral ecology still persists at the NewsHour. We still do things according to the moral standards that he set. And that was just teaching us how to be better people in a subtle way without sermons or lectures. And so the difference between the two mountains, the final difference, is in the first mountain you're shooting for happiness, which is what happens when you win a personal victory. If your team wins the Super Bowl, you get a promotion, you're attaining your goals, the self enlarges. On the second mountain, you're shooting for joy. And those are the moments when you forget about yourself. When you're lost in love of a kid, or you're lost in your work, or you're lost in love of some transcendent ideal. I have a friend named Christian Wyman, who was a poet, and if you ask him about his life, early in his life he was living in all these strange cities, and you ask him, why were you in Buffalo? He said, well, there's a woman there. Why were you in Cincinnati? There's a woman there. He went around the world with different women. And he was living in Prague because there was a woman there. And he was sitting on sitting at the kitchen working on a poem, and a falcon landed on the windowsill. And it was such a beautiful bird that he called his girlfriend out from the shower, and she runs out dripping, and they look at this falcon. And then the falcon turns its head and locks eyes with Wyman. And Wyman says, I felt all my insides just tumbling into themselves. And I felt I was staring into centuries, just locked in this with this bird. And his girlfriend understood the sort of the drama of the moment. And she said, make a wish. And he wrote a poem about that moment. And it has this stanza. And for a long moment I'm still in. I wished and wished and wished and wished that the moment would not end. And just like that, it vanished. So he had a moment of really spiritual transcendence, seeing into nature, and then it went away. But for people on the second mountain, for some of them at least, the moment of joy does not go away. It's just their permanent outlook. I get to work because of Weave with Yo-Yo Ma, and that guy is just joyful all the time. I was seated next to the Dalai Lama at a party in Washington, at a dinner, and he didn't say anything particularly profound, which was a disappointment to me. But he did laugh for no apparent reason at random moments. He just radiated laughter, and he laughed, and I wanted to be polite, so I laughed, and he laughed, and I laughed. And he just radiated light. And I meet these people, especially the weavers, and I meet some people who are just giving their life away, and they're just grateful for small pleasures and delighted in seeing other people succeed. And when the self and the ego has been tamed to some degree, then the result can be joy. And we're in a national valley, but my basic faith is that people figure stuff out, that people are basically ingenious, and they adopt the culture they need for that moment. And we've had 60 years of a pretty individualistic culture. We've sort of run out the string on it. And we'll have a culture shift, and we'll get out of our valley. And this book is really an effort, a small effort, to push us a little in that direction. Thank you. So we have two mic runners. I see one hand right there. And all I ask, first, that only 80% of the questions be about the Mueller report.
This might be one of the 20%. I'm wondering how this personal transformation has affected your politics.
Yeah. It's made me more communitarian, for sure. And, I mean, I'm much more, what can government do? I mean, you adapt to the problems of the moment. And frankly, I came of age in politics of stagflation in the 1970s. I frankly think we needed to liberate the economy a little. But that's not our problem anymore. High tax rates are not our problem anymore. Our problem is social isolation and disconnection. And so what can we do to set up people so they have the capacity to form relationships? Government doesn't form relationships, but it can provide service. Only people can provide care. But government can create platforms where there's care, through better schools, through national service programs, through nurse-family partnerships, through a lot of policies. So in that sense, it's made me more communitarian, but there's right-wing communitarianism and left-wing communitarianism. And so I would say I've moved left economically, maybe a little right socially. But the other thing, the biggest change that has been caused by this this year-long trip with these weavers is seen firsthand at bludgeoning detail the level of racial rage at racial injustice, and have come really to feel that we're at a moment of our almost moral breaking point on racial issues, a moral make or break moment. And so I used to think reparations were sort of just impossible to do, but now I think they're sort of important to do, and not necessarily out of white guilt or anything, but just as a sign of respect. because we're at a moment where our politics now overlaps with our racial divide, and that's a very poisonous position to be in.
There is a valley that a lot of us seem to get into. This is the valley of judgment. We judge people, and we don't want them to be this, or we don't want them to be that. We don't want them to have abortion. We don't want them to have gay marriage. How does this develop, and how do we get out of that?
Well, first, we're naturally, C.S. Lewis says, we have a premature evaluating attitude toward everything. It's very hard not to be judgmental right away. But then when you, and I'm quoting Hannah Arendt, I'm really dropping a lot of names here. You can see I'm a professor's kid. I'm blaming on him. I'm forgetting what I was going to say. She wrote that all forms of fanaticism come out of existential anxiety. That if you are insecure about your moral place in the world, if you're insecure about your physical place in the world, then judgment, you rush to judgment. And you do have that scarcity mentality that says it's us versus them, there's not enough for all of us. And let's face it, seeing it to another person is hard. My mind is fresh with these meeting with 250 people, and some of them were from New Orleans, some of them were from Nebraska. And frankly, all these people are great people. They both left our meeting exhilarated on one hand, but feeling unseen by the other. It's just really hard to find somebody you have nothing in common with and see them. And I have a friend who, sometimes I'll ask him for advice on something, and he'll ask me 6 questions. And I somehow think the rhythm now is he's going to give me his advice. But then he asks another 8 questions. He asks way more than seems natural. But that means he's a really good listener. And he's able to have that thing, negative capacity, the capacity to withhold judgment. But to have that capacity, you have to be able to live with uncertainty. It's a very hard thing to do when you feel yourself existentially anxious. You rush to judgment. And, you know, one thing I've learned in politics is you go to a Trump rally and you interview someone, you have a stereotype of what a Trump voter is, but then you actually interview somebody at a Trump rally. It's a feminist, lesbian, tennis player. You know, they all defy all the categories. People are just way more complicated. And so that's one thing that politics teaches you, to not think you know what you're seeing at first blush.
Thank you for coming to Philadelphia.
Pleasure.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So a few weeks ago, I was reading the Washington Post, and I saw Bob Samuelson challenged you very publicly. I was wondering what your thoughts were about what he wrote and whether he's really wrong or whether you think he might have something when he's evaluating your work and your writing.
Yeah, he was one column in particular where I was upset at the values of the meritocracy. And he's a friend, and this is what we do, we argue. I thought it was very respectful. It didn't bother me at all, by the way, just personally. If you want to find out people who really hate me, read the comments at the end of my column. And so it was David Brooks' Loosen Up, we're not in that bad a shape. And economically, he's an economics writer primarily. He's right. And Steven Pinker from Harvard just wrote a book a few years ago on how everything's getting better. And if you look at all his data sets, I find it very compelling. The world's safer. Everything is getting better except for the quality of relationships. If you're Robert Putnam at Harvard, who's a sociologist, the numbers are all going in the wrong direction. Social distrust is a very powerful predictor. Do you trust the institutions of your society? It used to be 80%, now it's 22%. I mentioned the statistic about our neighbors. I mentioned the statistic at suicide. You know, mental health rates, we think we know a lot about the brain. Mental health problems are skyrocketing, not dropping. Depression rates are skyrocketing. And so if your primary focus is economic, we're doing pretty great. If your primary focus is relational, emotional, sociological, then we're really not doing very well. And so I do think the society is complex, and I happen to think that the nature of our relationships shapes almost everything else. And so on the most important factor, we're not doing so great, which is why it feels crappy to be in American public life right now. It does not feel good. And so I think I'm more right than him, but he's a little right, which is generally a good rule to go through in life. Rebecca.
It seems like the world is going through a number of transformations, but one of the clearest, it seems to me, is the fact that the smartphone has really only been around for maybe a decade, and yet it has transformed life. It's easy to make judgments, right? You like or you don't like, or you put things online. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on how one reaches beyond that to actually develop relationships.
Yeah. There's a woman named Jean Twenge who teaches at UC San Diego, who's a big researcher on why the suicide rate is rising so quickly. And she points that it correlates perfectly with the introduction of the smartphone. And that's for a lot of reasons. You're more isolated if you're just on the phone. I mean, think about text, Snapchat, Instagram communication. It's not exactly deep heart and soul communication. It's pure ego communication. Either look how great my life is or look how stupid you are. And then there's the problem of comparison. I was mentioning at dinner, there's one psychologist I ran into who said young people use the social media to project a lot of personas, none of which are their actual persona. And that makes you undermined and fragile. And my view is moderately optimistic about this. New technologies come along, and at first we think they're great, and then we see the downsides. And Neil Ferguson points out that when the printing press came along in the 16th century, people thought, oh, great, we'll have decades and years of peace because we'll be able to communicate with each other, we'll understand each other. Instead, we had 300 years of religious wars. And so the smartphone has created huge downsides, especially for the young. But I sort of think we're figuring it out. I was in Silicon Valley for about 4 days, 3 weeks ago, and they're super strict with their kids about smartphones. They're no longer technophoria. I was at TED, everybody was anti-technology all of a sudden. And we'll figure it out. I have a friend who has a bunch of rituals to control it. And so one of them is, before he turns on any screen, he goes outside every morning and looks at the sky. Just thinks, I'm going to orient myself around the sky, not my screen. And then he practices a Sabbath, which is 1 hour a day, 1 day a week, and I think 1 week or month a year, no screens. And then there are certain rooms in his home where screens are allowed, certain rooms where screens are not allowed. And when his kids were little, the screens could be on the outside of a room, but at the center of the room, he would put crayons and Lego and stuff like that, creative stuff, to focus them on that stuff. And so I have a feeling we'll figure out how to control screen use, because it is, even for me, it's psychotically addictive. They say if you want to drive a mouse insane, give it irregularly timed rewards. So like drop a pellet at irregular times, because then it always thinks the pellet is coming. And I always think the next email is going to be interesting. And it never is.
Do you think that the populace are deliberately making our institutions feel illegitimate and demeaning education, demeaning the judiciary, demeaning media, et cetera? And do you think that is a cause or an effect?
I think that's an effect. So I wrote 8 million columns on why, in 2015, don't worry, Donald Trump will never get the Republican nomination. And even when he was giving the oath of office and going down Pennsylvania, I was still saying, don't worry, this won't happen. I've spent a lot of time in the last 2.5-3 years out in Trump world. And they just think the institutions have all completely failed them. And so some of that is financial crisis, some of that is Iraq war. I mentioned this town in North Carolina, Wilkes, North Carolina. In 1975, or I think it might have been 1990, the median income was 52,000. 7 years later, it was 31,000. And so then if you look at Trump voters are not actually that poor. Their median income was 74, but they're in towns that are collapsing. So the anger is not about themselves, it's about the community around them. And so they've seen their institutions fail, and their attitude is burn it all down. And I see that on the left, by the way, too. Just a burn it all down mentality. We need to make systemic change, let's burn it all down. And I'm a Burkean, so I always think that's the wrong answer. But that is their judgment. And then I think individualism has undermined institutions. I mean, I often go back to cultural explanations. When George Marshall, who was in my last book, went to the army, he said, I'm going to serve the institution of the army. He was here before I was born. It's got standards of excellence I'll try to live up to. I'll steward it for a while. I'll try to pass it along. That's an institutional mindset. That institutional mindset is much rarer. In about a year, a friend of mine named Yuval Levin has a book coming out where he says, we used to think of as institutions as formative. We'd go into the army or we'd go into the Boy Scouts so it could form us. Now they're performative. We use them as platforms on which we can shine our light on our individual selves. And to me, the best example of that is the United States Senate. There used to be senators who really loved the institution, and they loved the rules, Robert Byrd, even Arlen Specter. They just wanted to serve the Senate. Now the Senate is just a platform for them to write books and go on TV. And they'll violate any Senate rule or any Senate tradition if it'll help with their career or help with their side. And so we see the decay of that institution. And so having an institutional mindset is what people built institutions like this had. And it's seeing distantly into the future. And that too is a little scarcer.
In terms of getting out of valleys and heading towards mountains and the work that the weavers do, does religion play a part in any of that, as you see it or as they see it?
In about half of them. It depends where you are. If you're in the South, religion just is everywhere. If you're in black culture, religion is much more common. It comes up a lot more. But and there are some, you know, there are some families I've met who have, there's a guy I met named Pancho who lives on the Texas border. He works with immigrants in crisis. And what he mostly does is when a Latino worker with papers or without papers falls at work and breaks his back and is paralyzed, the company immediately fires him. It's Texas, there's no workers' comp. And so the guy has nothing. And so what Pancho does is he gets the guy wheelchairs, diapers, catheters, anything so he can live a dignified life. And this is the least romantic work you can imagine. And I think Pancho is just driven by just religious faith. But I would say I do not observe much difference of behavior in society at large between the religious and the not religious. The religious talk more about virtue and grace and goodness, so you'd think they'd behave a lot better. But while there are some measurable differences, charitable donations and other things, it's not as big as you'd expect. And I think that's because that we are all people, you know, it's like Viktor Frankl, we're all driven to try to be good. And so there are a lot of people who lead lives of amazing self-sacrificial service but have no religious faith at all, and I've found no ability to generalize one side better than the other.
Why did you become more socially conservative?
Because I've, so many, in my AOK community, my DC community, and maybe you can quibble whether this is really socially conservative, the pattern that runs through so many lives is the pattern of male barbarism. Men abusing girls, men abandoning families, and so somehow the basic standards of honor and gentlemanliness have not been passed along, and frankly, a commitment to marriage has not been passed along. I reported on a study that interviewed about 170 working class men in depth, and the men said they were very committed to their kids, no commitment at all to the women who gave birth to those kids. And so if you don't have a relationship with the mother of the kid, you're probably not going to end up having a relationship with the kid. And so what you have is a lot of kids who are like Darren, who I mentioned, who are just left. And they all have father issues. And so the preservation of marriage and sort of traditional family mores seems to me much more important. And I have friends who make the obvious point that if you grow up in upper middle class progressive America, you have a lot of people who talk left but live right on family values. And so I just become more old-fashioned about that stuff, I think.
Thank you. We were getting a little concerned about your peripheral vision.
What am I, Allen Iverson? What do you
want? So I was really encouraged with Obama's heading us towards a positive place. And, you know, maybe it was partly where I come from that I could feel that, but I feel betrayed now. And as we move towards this new space you want us to find, are we going to get duped? Are we going to see other leaders, that charlatans that take us places? How are we going to do this?
Well, where was the betrayal? Was it betrayal by Obama or by the American people?
Well, that's a good question. I was encouraged to the point where I felt America could rise. And so I guess it was the American people. But the leadership took us in the right direction. And that's what I'm so missing right now.
Yeah. Well, I sort of share your basic orientation. And I think Obama was still president, but the campaign was happening. I wrote a column called I Miss Barack Obama Already, and I still do. But I guess two things to be said, and I think there was a certain sense, it's interesting to see what happens when you lose faith in your own countrymen. And I think that's sort of what's happened. There was an assumption that the American people were basically good, and a lot of progressive or people more on the Democratic side have lost faith in that. And I see it reflected in an interesting choice. I hear this all the time among Democratic voters. We have to nominate a white man because America will never support another non-white man. That, to me, is sort of a morally problematic position to take. But losing faith in your democracy, I mean, our founders understood democracy is a very unstable form of government and that it has to be sustained by a faith, the basic faith that the people will choose wisely. And once that faith begins to erode, it erodes quickly. I think Madison wrote about this. And so the loss of that faith is severe. But to be fair, I was a foreign correspondent in the 90s for the Wall Street Journal. I lived in Brussels. And I covered all this great news. And it was like the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of the Soviet Union, Mandela coming out of prison in South Africa, the Oslo peace process in the Middle East. All this stuff. It seemed like barriers were falling and things were going in the right direction. And the last event I covered was the Yugoslav Civil War. And in retrospect, that was the most important event I covered, because the ensuing 25 or 30 years have been about ethnic nationalism, strongman politics, and alienation. And so it's not only happening here. There are certain pivotal moments in history where the same sorts of problems happen in different forms in a lot of different countries all at once. And 1968 was an obvious example of that. 1848 was an example of that. And we're another example of that. And it's a pivot moment. But I have basic faith in people's ability to figure it out. There's somebody, I quote in the book, I forgot her name, a social theorist, who says history moves forward by what she calls the ratchet, hatchet, pivot, ratchet process. There's a problem. You develop a culture to solve it, you ratchet upwards. It doesn't work, so you got to chop it up. And those chop it up moments are very bumpy. But then we figure out another answer, and we pivot over, and we ratchet up. And I'm made hopeful by work that Robert Putnam has coming out in a few years, probably. But he compares our period to the period of the late 1890 to 1910. In 1890, we had a big economic transition. Like us, we had a big wave of immigration, we had a lot of political corruption. It's sort of like similar. And so what happened? By 1910, a lot of progress had been made. And so what happened? First, there was a religious cultural revival. Social Darwinism, which was very individualistic, was replaced by the social gospel movement, which was very communal. And then there was a civic revival. You had the creation of the YMCA, the Boy Scouts, the Boys clubs, the temperance movement, the settlement house movement, the NAACP, the unions. Within a few years, you had the rise of all these civic institutions, basically because people looked around and realized all our institutions were built for a country where all the kids were being raised in the prairie of Kansas. And suddenly you had millions of kids being raised, immigrant kids raised in Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, Chicago. They needed new institutions. So there was a civic revival. And then 30 years later, there was a political revival called the Progressive Movement. And so it went cultural, civic, political. And as I look around the country, I think we're in the middle of a civic revival. A lot of people are doing a lot of new stuff. I hope we're in the dawn of a cultural revival. Politics, not so much. But it'll move in that process, maybe. And so that's my source for an awareness of that things get better. Usually we figure stuff out. And that's the source of an insane and entirely unjustified level of optimism. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.